So what's the universal time? Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. The United States has announced its suspending participation in bilateral channels with Russia to keep a cessation of hostilities in Syria going. Elizabeth Trudeau is a U.S. spokesperson.
Russia and the Syrian regime have chosen to pursue a military course inconsistent with the cessation of hostilities, is demonstrated by intensified attacks against civilian area, targeting of critical infrastructure such as hospitals, preventing humanitarian aid from reaching civilians in need.
She said Russia was unwilling to halt violence against the rebel-held sector of Aleppo.
The Russians made very clear that they would not cease the attacks that we're seeing, that we saw this weekend, that we saw the attack against the hospital.
In Geneva Monday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon said he was speechless about the carnage in Aleppo.
I strongly condemn the deliberate campaign against the civilians and the health workers and humanitarian personnel trying to save them. The parties have first obligation. Countries with influence are also responsible for ending the attacks.
UN diplomats said the Security Council will begin discussions on a draft resolution that will urge Russia and the U.S. to ensure an immediate truce in Aleppo. Meanwhile, the U.S. confirmed the targeting of a prominent al-Qaeda leader in Syria in a drone strike. Jihadist sources identify him as Sheikh Abu al-Faraj al-Masri. At least 9 migrants died Monday in the ongoing flow of people from Africa to Europe. It was a day that saw more than 5,600 migrants rescued by the Italian Coast Guard and humanitarian groups from dozens of boats in the Mediterranean off the Libyan coast. It was one of the highest numbers taken off often unseaworthy craft in one lay and relocated to Italian ports. This is VOA News. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a decree suspending an agreement with Washington on disposing of weapons-grade plutonium. It cited a drastic change in circumstances, a threat to strategic stability as a result of what it called unfriendly actions by the U.S. and Washington's failure to fulfill its obligations. White House spokesman Josh Earnest expressed disappointment, saying Washington remains committed to limiting proliferation, reducing the risk of nuclear terrorism.
The plutonium arrangement is one that does reflect the shared priorities of our two countries. We're hopeful that the Russians will recognize that and follow through on the commitments that they've made.
The deal has called for both nuclear powers to dispose of weapons-grade plutonium from their defense programs. In Afghanistan, security forces continue fighting to retain control of the northern city of Kunduz. After Taliban fighters pushed into the city's center, they briefly captured a year ago. RAND Corporation analyst Jonah Blank said the new assault shows the continued fighting capability of the Taliban.
The Taliban has shown that it can launch sophisticated and serious attacks in multiple sites at the same time. This attack on Kunduz was reported to have come from 4 directions at once.
The latest fighting came ahead of a 2-day international donors conference on Afghanistan in Brussels. Colombia's government and Marxist rebels are trying to determine the next step in the peace process that was halted by Sunday's rejection of an agreement to end more than half a century of conflict. Voters in Colombia narrowly defeated the deal that critics call too lenient toward the rebels, that in a conflict that killed a 250,000 people and displaced millions.
Como lo dije anoche, el país necesita
President Juan Manuel Santos said the country needs unity, not grudges, hatred, and polarization. He met with the country's political parties, called on chief critic former President Alvaro Uribe to help him renegotiate and strengthen the pact. Turkey has extended a state of emergency imposed following last July's failed coup. It said beginning October 19, the state of emergency will be extended another 3 months. The government insists that basic freedoms will be preserved, but said the state of emergency is necessary to continue its crackdown on suspects implicated in the attempted coup. An annual survey finds governance in Africa improved little over the past decade because of a lack of security and respect for the rule of law. The Ibrahim Index of African Governance rated 54 nations on such criteria as safety, human rights, and corruption. Mauritius held the top spot, followed by Botswana, Cape Verde, the Seychelles, and Namibia. Japanese scientist Yoshinori Osumi was awarded this year's Nobel Prize for Medicine for his work in autophagy, the science of how cells break down and recycle their content.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zambian police summon opposition UPND leader and his vice presidential candidate for questioning tomorrow, Wednesday.
We are waiting to see what the police are going to charge him with, and we are determined that come these charges, it is a temporary delay. We are going to continue to march forward until we liberate our country completely.
Cornelius Mwitwa is the deputy spokesman for the opposition UPND Party of Zambia. Liberian public school teachers are in discussion with education ministry officials after disagreement on outsourcing aspects of public education. And South Sudan's government gave the green light for the deployment of a UN protection force.
The council issued very strong policy directive and orders to all the government agencies to immediately move to implement the recommendations of our technical team without failure and without delay.
Martin Lomuro is South Sudan's Minister for Cabinet Affairs. South Sudanese in the diaspora meet with visiting First Vice President Tabar Dengai, and the Zimbabwe government dehorns rhinos to fight poaching. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zambian police have summoned opposition UPND leader Hakainde Hichilema and his vice presidential candidate in the August election to appear tomorrow, Wednesday, for questioning over allegations he incited residents of Mpungwe district in the country's Copper Belt region to rise up against the government. Hichilema lost the August 11 election to incumbent Edgar Lungu. The Constitutional Court rejected his petition against the results. Cornelius Mwitwa, a member of Parliament and deputy spokesman of the UPND, says the police claims of incitement are a mere fabrication. He says the government is looking for a reason to arrest Mr. Hichilema and his vice presidential candidate, Jeffrey Bualia Mwamba.
So far, the facts we have are that they want to charge him for kind of unlawful assembly because last week he was trying to go visit some colleagues who are incarcerated in prison on the Copper Belt, and on the way to the Copper Belt, he stopped by some marketplace to buy some commodities so that he would be able to give to the colleagues who are incarcerated in prison. And then we are told, amounted to unlawful assembly. And so that is the basis, basically, why he's being called to appear before the police.
The police commissioner of Mpungwe district said that Mr. Hichilema incited the residents to rise up against the government.
The district commissioner, actually, is a political appointee of the president who doesn't do any real meaningful work for the benefit of the citizens other than political engineering for the ruling party. And not be surprising that he came up with this fabrication that HH was inciting residents to rise against the state. But I'm not surprised. This is a country where law and order has broken down. It is now the rule of men and the will of men at play. So we're not surprised that such kind of allegations are being fronted against him. And as you would imagine, we in the UPND are no longer politicians. We are freedom fighters led by HH as freedom fighter number one. We are waiting to see what the police are going to charge him with. And we are determined that come these charges, it is a temporary delay. We are going to continue to march forward until we liberate our country completely.
You mentioned the UPND members who have been incarcerated, and this is following the election. Have you been able to see them?
Last week, HH and his running mate had actually gone to try and go visit these colleagues who are in incarceration, and they were not allowed. The members of parliament also tried to go and visit them. The members of parliament were told that no, because you boycotted the ceremonial opening of parliament as opposition and you embarrassed the head of state, you are not going to visit your colleagues in prison. So basically, this is the new Zambia we live in. The former Zambia, which was a beacon of peace, unity, where the neighboring regions would have refuge in, I think it is slowly, seriously, but quickly disappearing. We are becoming the nation that we used to watch from a distance we are now becoming the same.
You said that the police denied him permission to visit members of his party who are in jail. Did he get permission before going to visit?
Well, there is no law that requires somebody who is going to visit people who are in incarceration to get some permission or notification to anybody. Except in a lawless state of affairs that we are in, people are going to begin to cry out of their preference. Certain conditionalities that must be met before somebody, for instance, will be able to go and visit people in prison. Otherwise, visiting somebody in prison, you don't require notification, you don't require permission. You just have to be there whenever it is visiting time.
Cornelius Mwitwa is a member of parliament and deputy spokesman of the opposition United Party for National Development of Zambia. You are speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. The South Sudan government has given a green light for the deployment of regional UN Protection Force. South Sudan's Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Lumoro says the government has directed all institutions to cooperate with the United Nations in preparation for the deployment of the additional 4,000 troops. Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Cabinet Affairs Minister Martin Elia Lomoro says they are waiting for the arrival of the Regional Protection Force. Lomoro says all government institutions will cooperate with UNMISS.
And the Council issued very strong policy directive and orders to all the government agencies, and especially those security sectors that are concerned with the implementation of UN Security Council Resolution 2304 and the communique that we signed jointly, to immediately move to implement the recommendations of our technical team that met with UNMISS without failure and without delay.
Lomoro did not specify when the government expects the protection forces to arrive in the country, but says the government will help accompany the smooth operation of the new peacekeeping forces, including their patrol and the clearance of goods and equipment that belong to the peacekeeping troops.
These include issues of deployment and security arrangement for Juba, the protection of civilians, Juba International Airport, and other key installations as agreed between our technical team and the UNMISS technical team.
Lomoro says once the technical team is ready and all arrangements have been completed, the government will inform the UN it is ready for the protection force to arrive in the country. It is not clear what prompted the government to change its position on the deployment of the regional protection force. Jacob Chol, head of the Political Science Department at the University of Juba, says the government's decision to agree without conditions will help improve the already tainted image of the government after earlier refusal to allow the deployment of the regional force in July.
The government seeing itself not really with the international community, and the government seeing itself, well, it is a time to clean its image and to be able to really live within what the international community said.
Joel says the government is taking advantage of recent remarks by American officials discouraging rebel leader Riek Machar from taking up an armed resistance against Juba.
One of the ways is that the government realized that the United States, which is leading the international community, has basically told Riek perhaps to leave the rebellion, play a non-violent approach, and perhaps stay out of South Sudanese politics. And this perhaps could be what has prevented the government to agree on regional protection force in practice now.
Chol says accepting the regional force will enable the government to gain respect from the international community on which it relies on humanitarian and financial support. But Chol warns the protection force will not be able to completely end the fighting in South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, October 4th. And please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. South Sudan's first vice president, Taban Dengai, who is currently visiting the United States, has been meeting with the South Sudan diaspora here. Deng met over the past weekend with about 80 members of the diaspora. As Ayen Bio reports, some ask pointed questions about the fit of their country.
The first vice president's core message was that the transitional government of national unity is committed to implementing the peace deal and is on track to building the infrastructures and institutions necessary to build the country. John Woi Leek, a South Sudanese community leader in the Washington metropolitan area, is skeptical about Deng's assurances, saying many people in the United States and abroad are still loyal to Deng's former boss, Riek Machar.
The question is now, what is General Thaban willing to do to bring on board people that are diehard supporters of Dr. Riek? That's one thing. Two, there is also an evidence that is showing that Thaban Dengai may not have support on the ground.
During his weekend address to the diaspora, Deng urged South Sudanese not to incite hate or controversy on the internet and advised people not to take to social media to attack communities in South Sudan. Leek says he agrees with that message, but also reminded Deng that the diaspora has worked tirelessly over the last decade to bring independence and development to their home country, something that has not happened.
The diaspora has been the one that was advocating for the CPA to happen. There is no point for us 16 years later on, 15 years later on, that we'll come back and sell the country.
Leek says members of the community have spoken to lawmakers in the U.S. to try to impose an arms embargo in South Sudan and have advocated for a new bill that will potentially send South Sudanese back home to help rebuild the country. But he says for many like him, their work doesn't seem to make a difference, leaving them frustrated. Reverend Samuel Thaban, who leads a South Sudanese congregation in Falls Church, Virginia, just outside of Washington, D.C., says he's fed up with leaders who preach peace while at the same time urge their sympathizers to wage war. While offering a prayer during the meeting with the first vice president, Reverend Thaban took a moment to read from the Sermon of the Mount in the Bible's Book of Matthew, which says, "Blessed are the peacemakers."
Our leaders talk about peace, right? What kind of peace are they talking about? In one hand, they say they're talking about peace. In another hand, they talk about the wage war. So how will you compare those things together to match that you are really a man of peace? That's why I believe them. They're not really true leaders who could say a true thing, and they're not really concerned about our people.
Despite his skepticism, Reverend Thaban says he remains hopeful that the first vice president will deliver on his promises to stop the violence in South Sudan. But he notes that South Sudanese are going to need more than empty promises from politicians to believe that real change is possible. Ayen Bior, VOA News, Washington.
The Pan-African Lawyers Union says it will not stop appealing the case of Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to seek a third term. This comes after the East African Court of Justice last week dismissed a case which had been filed by civil society groups in Burundi, Tanzania, Uganda, Rwanda, and Kenya against the government of Bujumbura, challenging last year's general election results. Moses Javier Rimana reports from Bujumbura.
The debate over the Burundian president's decision to run for another term has been going on now since last year. There has been violence over the decision, which the opposition believe was unconstitutional. The Pan-African Lawyers Union last year moved the case to the East African Court of Justice after the National Constitutional Court had approved President Pierre Nkurunziza's candidacy. Mr. Ifnalis Okubo is a registrar at the East African Court of Justice.
Well, the court dismisses the case because this court is not an appellate court to overrule what a constitutional court of a country has done. Yeah, so there's no way the court was going to overrule what a constitutional court of a country has done because this court is not an appellate court. That is what the prayers which the people who filed the case wanted, because they wanted that this court reverses what a constitutional court has done, and that is not possible.
The registrar said that the dismissal of the case doesn't mean that the regional court had agreed with the Burundi Constitutional Court's decision.
It's not that we follow what that court has, the national court has done, but the way the prayers were being asked, what they were requesting was for this court to annul what a national court has done. That means it was like an appeal, and this court doesn't have mandate for an appeal.
In 2005, President Nkurunziza was elected by the parliament in line with Article 302 of the Constitution, which allows exceptionally the first president of the Republic of the post-transitional period to be elected by the National Assembly and the Senate. Nkurunziza's supporters say this five-year term, which ended in 2010, shouldn't be regarded. Evelyn Chijarira is the Pan-African Lawyers Union legal officer.
What we asked them to do was, if someone has agreed to be bound by the East African Community Treaty, they're supposed to abide by the rules of rule of law and everything as stated by the East African Community Treaty. If you look at the process in which the whole confirmation by the Constitutional Court was done, was it free and fair? No, it was not fair. Because even the vice president of the court ran away and is now living in exile.
Article 96 of Burundi's constitution indicates that the president of the republic is directly elected by the universal suffrage for one term of 5 years, renewable once. In 2015, the country's constitutional court ruled in Nkurunziza's favor after Kote's vice president fled the country. The Pan-African Lawyers Union say this was a sign of the court being influenced.
We also asked the court to look at the Arusha Agreement. This is not right, because the constitution is very clear, so as the Arusha Declaration.
More than 1,000 people have been killed since last year, when protests against the incumbent president erupted. Dialogue between the government and the opposition seems to be the way out of the current crisis. However, progress in the dialogue remains uncertain after the Burundi government said it will not sit together with some opposition leaders whom it accuses of plotting last year's failed coup. Moses Habyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has instructed her embattled education minister to close all public schools and dismiss teachers who have been protesting against the government's decision to outsource part of its primary education system to a private company. Titi Gibro reports from Monrovia.
A week after Liberia's public school teachers went on strike demanding the resignation of Education Minister George Wenner, hundreds of students, especially from Magibi County near the capital, took to the streets demanding their rights to education. The students blocked the major highway leading to the country's international airport, causing many outbound passengers to miss their flights. Upon her return to the country last week, after attending the UN General Assembly in New York, President Sirleaf instructed her besieged education minister to shut down schools involved with the protest.
No one has a right to infringe on the rights of others because of your grievance. You have a grievance, you have a means to carry your grievance to the right place so it can be resolved. We are not going to allow students or any other protest group to be able to infringe on people in such a way that it causes injury to them. I'm going to instruct the Ministry of Education to close those schools immediately. And we are going to ask for those students who are involved to see how we deal with them. If there were teachers involved, they are going to be dismissed until we see how they can handle themselves as teachers in the classroom. Today, we're going to start a program of discipline.
4 months into the school year after he took over in 2015, Minister George Wenner closed schools, promoting students who did not complete the curriculum. The minister then introduced what he called the Education Reform Policy. As part of its reform policy and as a pilot project, the ministry has outsourced part of the country's primary public education system to some private providers. Critics say outsourcing the primary education system to private, including for-profit providers, may eventually lead to the privatization of education in Liberia. Public school teachers, among others concerned, claim they were never consulted nor involved in the decision to outsource and the taking over of their school buildings. But a day following President Sirleaf's pronouncement, Education Minister George Wenner addressed the media and claimed the National Teachers Association has been cooperative in many of the ministry's adventures. Minister Wenner accused unnamed non-governmental organizations of financing the National Teachers Association to rebel against the government. But he said the Ministry of Education is not deterred.
The Partnership Schools initiative will go on. I know the NTAL doesn't like it. And not that as Liberians they don't like it, but they are being pushed by some NGOs giving financing to oppose it. One of them is Education International. They are headquartered in Brussels.
When asked to comment on President Sirleaf's and the minister's remarks, the NTAL said the president has instructed the National Christian Society and OMIL to negotiate between them and the Education Ministry so as to amicably resolve the issue. The NTAL said it has been instructed not to speak to the press until the talks are concluded. Titi Gibro, VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
Zimbabwe's Wildlife Authority has embarked on an exercise of dehorning rhinos as part of its efforts to fight poaching and save the endangered species from extinction. As Sebastian Mofu reports, not everyone agrees with this approach.
Matoro National Park, about 500 kilometers southwest of Harare, is one of the few places we still have rhinos in Zimbabwe. Poachers have been killing them for their horn and smuggling them mainly to Asia, says the government. Kola Mjuau, a senior ecologist with Zimbabwe's National Parks and Wildlife Authority, says if the horn is removed, the animal may not become extinct.
Our focus on dehorning is not something which we are initiating only as Zimbabwe. This is something which we are initiating as a region. The motivation here, especially this year, is if you look at the statistics regionally, South Africa, that's where most of the rhino poaching is. And they've actually upped their game in terms of law enforcement, in terms of security. And there are high chances that the poachers are looking elsewhere now. It is most probably they could be turning to Zimbabwe.
Africa now has about 5,000 black rhinos compared to about 65,000 back in 1964, according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature and Natural Resources, Red List. Other animals on the list include cheetahs. The African Wildlife Foundation attributes this decline to poachers taking advantage of the poverty of locals. Zimbabwe has been battling to keep its wildlife, which includes white and black rhinos, from poachers with little success. Now it has resorted to dehorning its remaining rhinos. Johnny Rodriguez, the chairman of the Zimbabwe Conservation Task Force, says this approach may not work.
We don't believe in it. The biggest problem is this crime syndicates, where there's a lot of big chefs involved. That's why they can't bring it to an end. And even when you dehorn the rhino, the poacher doesn't know because they're hunting them at night, so they just shoot the animal anyway. So you're dehorning it for nothing. We should put more people in there to safeguard.
Big chefs refers to the involvement of senior government officials in poaching, an allegation which President Robert Mugabe's government has vehemently denied on several occasions, asking for proof. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Somalia experts and officials say elections face further delays unless the country's seven-member National Leadership Forum takes action. The Federal Indirect Electoral Independent Team warned on Monday that there will be more delays if there is no political agreement on Hiran and Middle Shabelle, the last regional administrations that need to be established before the elections take place. The president and prime minister, both members of the NLF, expressed differences over the venue of selection of the new region's parliament, with the president proposing Mogadishu and the prime minister insisting it be left with the region. And that's it for this Tuesday, October 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, along with our engineer Charles Hall, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing everyone in Africa a very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, former South Sudan First Vice President Riek Machar has called for an armed struggle against the government of President Salva Kiir, a move that could mark a renewal of the country's civil war. We'll discuss the new developments in South Sudan next on Straight Talk Africa at 18:30 UTC.
On November 8th, American citizens will exercise their right to vote and choose their next president. VOA is providing comprehensive coverage of this unique democratic process. Who is going to earn the trust of the American people to lead the nation for the next 4 years? Find out right here on VOA.